want to speak about the 10 plagues and what purpose they served. Torah tells us right away in the beginning of this Sedra, Ki hichbariti es libo, yes leib avodah, that you go to speak to Paro because I've hardened his heart and the heart of his servants. Laman shisi ososai eila bikirbo, in order that I should be able to put these wonders, these signs, in his midst. And the second thing it says, Laman tesaper boozne bincho, ben bincho, in order that you should be able to tell your children and grandchildren, Esa shir hisalalti bimitzrayim, how I mocked the Egyptians, the esososai asher samtibam, and the wonders and miracles and signs that I put in them, and then you'll know that I'm God. So by the Egyptians, it says, in order I should put these signs amongst them. When we're telling it over, it adds something, that we should know how HaKadosh Baruch Hu mocked the Egyptians, in addition to the signs and wonders. So let me explain what I think the idea is. First of all, there's a Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash says that the 10 plagues follow the same pattern as people coming to war with another nation. First they attack their water supply, that was the dam, and it goes on and explains the process of waging war on an enemy, and that the 10 plagues parallel the different stages of a war. Now, let me explain what I think that means. When you wage war with somebody, you don't want to have to have an all-out war. You would rather them surrender. So you do it gradually. You start in a way that hopefully will give them the understanding that it's better for them to surrender than to wage an all-out war. And you go from what's it called, from one stage to the next stage, a little bit more powerful or whatever, hopefully that you won't have to get to the last stage, we have an all-out war, and that's not desirable. Same thing over here, only for a different reason. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Egyptians to exercise their free choice. He wanted them to choose, Paro specifically, to let the Jewish people go. According to the Sfarno, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not harden Paro's heart to take away his free choice. Well, see, there's another opinion that says that he did. But the Sfarno says not. The reason Paro's heart was hardened was to enable him to have free choice. Because God wanted Paro to have the ability to say yes or to say no. And therefore, he knew that Paro was in a very, very difficult position to say yes because had all these slaves and he got used to having them, and letting all the slaves go would be very difficult for him to opt for. So therefore, he needed a little bit of coercion. So God brought all of these signs and wonders, but he didn't want him to be coerced because that would be counterproductive. He didn't want to force him to say yes. He wanted him on his own volition to say yes. So he hardened his heart that he would not have to be forced by these miracles, signs, wonders, plagues. On the other hand, he would, be able to say yes and have a good crutch why to say yes. Something that would, the plagues counterbalanced the reason why Paro couldn't say yes, and the hardening of his heart counterbalanced the plagues and made it that he didn't have to say yes. So in the end, he was left with free choice, where he could have said yes because of the plagues, and he still could have said no because of the hardening of his heart. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is concerned that even non-Jews should do what's right and do it on their own volition. That's why a person was put into this world, to be subservient to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to do his will. So God was concerned that Pharaoh and the Egyptians do his will and not be forced to do it, because we were put in this world to have free choice. So that's why it says, Laman shisi oso sayela. The word shos means to put. But it also has a connection to the fact that before this it says, Paro lo shos libo. He didn't put his heart. He didn't pay attention. The signs, wonders, plagues were to get Paro's attention, that he should pay attention, and that it should give him an incentive to want to choose to do what's right. And his heart was hardened just enough that it wouldn't force him to do what's right. So that's one idea. And his thinking, that explains another thing also. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu's whole request from Paro was not to let the slaves go, let the Jewish people go forever, but 3 days in the desert to sacrifice to God. Now, that lechora wasn't true. God told Moshe that he wants to take the Jewish people out of Egypt and bring them to Eretz Yisrael. They weren't just going 3 days and coming back. So why did the Ribbono Shel Olam present to Paro something that lechora was not true? There are many answers to that, which you're not going to go into now.
What happened?
Why did God present Paro with the request of letting the Jews go 3 days in the desert, which seemed to imply they were coming back,
right?
When in fact, he told Moshe Rabbeinu his intention is to take them out of Egypt for good and to bring them there to Israel. So why did he lie to Paro? One answer, I think, is based on this idea. God wanted Paro to be able to say yes. He didn't want him to be in a position where he couldn't say yes. So everything was done to balance his free choice. And therefore, had God come to Paro and said, send all your slaves for good, and that's it, right? Release them all for good. Paro could not have said yes. It would have been something impossible for him to agree to. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam came to him with an offer that he could say yes. And then, once he said yes to that, it's easier, you know, once you're on a roll of saying yes, then he can come with more and whatever. Never told him they're coming back, but he made it possible for him to fool himself into thinking that, in order they should be able to have a possibility of agreeing. And once he agreed, so they'll negotiate further and further and further. But it was all to give him free choice. We have this idea that, you know, as things progress, the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to do what's right. And in the end, you're going to do it whether you like it or not. But he wants you to choose to do it. So there is a gradual strengthening of the things that coerce a person to do what's right. But first, the ideal would be not to be coerced, to do it because you want to do it. Therefore, for instance, in 2 weeks ago, said the Ribbono Shel Olam told us to Moshe Rabbeinu, to go to the Jewish people, and to convince them with 3 miracles in his show. The first one, that the staff turned to a snake. The second one, that his hand became mitzora and then turned back. And the third one, the pair poured the water and turned to blood. And the Torah says, if they don't listen to the first one, they'll believe the second one. And if they don't believe the second one, the third one for sure they'll believe. So the obvious question is, if the third one is the one they're going to surely believe, then just start with the third one. Forget about the first two. But this is the concept. God wants them to choose to believe, not to be forced. So let's try first, let's see if they believe without any miracles. If yes, that's sort of a small miracle. So they have a little bit of a crutch, but most of it's their own choice. Then a little bit bigger miracle, a little bit more crutch. And if that doesn't help, better they should believe and have a big crutch than they should choose not to believe. But the ideal would have been that they choose on their own without having to be coerced, forced, whatever. The same thing we find in the Gemara. The Gemara says a person should always agitate his Yetzer HaTov to win over his Yetzer Hara. If he's successful, fine. If he's not successful, he should read Kriya Shema. That will help him.
Shema.
Right? If that doesn't help, learn Torah. Just the opposite. First, learn Torah. If that doesn't help, read Shema. And if that doesn't help, remember that you're mortal and that you're going to die one day. So then everybody asks, why don't you just start with remembering you're going to die? That's going to be more effective. The idea is, though, you don't want to force yourself. You want to do it willingly. So start first by trying to overpower Yetzer Hara totally with your own free will. Doesn't help. Use Torah as a crutch. That doesn't help. Use Shema as a crutch. That doesn't help, and use the biggest crutch. Better to do what's right and do it because you're coerced or because you're using a crutch than not to do it at all. But the ideal would be to do it because you want to do it. So that's one aspect of the 10 plagues, according to the Sfarno at least, that God wanted to preserve Paro's free choice. Slowly but surely, gradually, he brought more and more pressure on him that he should say yes, but he didn't want to pressure him in the beginning because he wanted to give him gradually decreasing free choice, but starting with as much free choice as he could have. Even according to the Rambam says from the fifth plague and on, God took away Paro's free choice. And that was part of his punishment. The Rambam, Maimonides. He says that Paro really was deserving of being killed after he'd listened to five plagues. But instead of killing him, God permitted him to live and used him as a pawn to teach lessons to the Jewish people and to the world. So he could have. So sometimes God takes away a person's free choice as a punishment and uses him as a pawn. And that's not so hard to understand because God could have killed Paro. That would have taken away his free choice pretty clearly. So if a person's punished that he's supposed to die, his free choice is taken away. He can't do tshuva anymore. He can't do anything. He's dead. So God can let a person live and still take away his free choice. So he's a pawn. He's a living dead man. He has no more bechira. God's using him now. But he's being punished for what he did before. That, he was already getting his punishment. He couldn't get a punishment to die. Instead, God let him live and used him as a pawn. But even the Rambam holds that the first five plagues could have served that purpose. By the first five plagues, Paro still had free choice. And God gradually brought the five plagues to build up the pressure, but slowly, so he would at least remain with free choice as long as possible. Hopefully he would have exercised his free choice properly. So that is, that's one idea. Okay, now how did the plagues, aside from being like an army where you let the enemy know that it's not worth his while to put up resistance because you can really put the screws on him and pressure him, right, little by little, there's another aspect over here. It says that the 10 plagues corresponded to the 10 utterances with which the world were created. God created the world with 10 utterances, and the 10 plagues paralleled them. What's the idea? The 10 utterances which God created the world represent God's mastery and creation of the world itself. Since God created the world, he's the master of the world. Okay? He brought everything into existence, and he is the source of existence on a constant basis. The 10 plagues showed that God controlled the world. The same God who brought the world into existence is still in control. And each plague showed a different aspect of control over the different aspects of creation, which are represented in the 10 utterances. And also, that everything in the world was created to do God's will. And when it doesn't do God's will, right, then it doesn't have a right to exist. In other words, what God showed is the breakdown of creation, right, especially vis-a-vis man, because man wasn't doing what he's supposed to be doing. Right? An example, right, the Rabban Shom said that I created water to give man life, that he should be able to do what he's supposed to do. But if man doesn't do what he's supposed to do, then I'll take the water away from him and take his life source away. Right, I have a deeper understanding of that, which maybe I'll mention to you now. And that is that the Nile represented the identity of the Egyptians. They identify with the Nile. And their identity was, we are self-made people. We control everything. That's how they looked at themselves. They could make magic and control nature. Paro said, the Nile is mine and I made it. They consider themselves in total control, and they consider themselves self-made people. God wanted to show them, if you don't understand that I gave you your life, and you have to use it in the way that I prescribe, then that life becomes bankrupt, putrid, harmful, or whatever. Your identity becomes harmful and negative. And therefore, what God said is the following. I created you, and I gave you life. And therefore, I put a liquid, a life-giving liquid within you that totally came from me. That's blood. You had nothing to do with your blood supply. Blood is the life of the person, and that is given by God. So that should remind you that you are a God-created being, and therefore you are beholden to your Creator. Okay, both because He is obviously stronger and more significant in your existence, and also because He's what's it called, the designer, and you are beholden to the design of the designer who designed you. So if you buy a car, you have to follow the instructions of the person who designed that car. You didn't design it. So God's the designer of the world. So the liquid that God put in is blood. And the, but God doesn't want us to be robots. He wants us to be dynamic and to preserve and promote our lives. So He gave us another liquid called water that we introduce. We drink. We are the ones who introduce that to preserve and promote the life that God gave us. But when we forget that God gave us our life, and we think we gave ourselves our life, we're basically conceptually changing blood into water. We're saying that blood, which is God's contribution, is really water. It's our contribution. So God said, fine, I'll show you what happens when you want to change blood into water, I'll change water into blood. See what happens. And then, once that blood, the water is turned into blood, you see how putrid it is. The fish died and stank. And then the frogs came from the Nile, which are noisy, bothersome, and damaging. And finally, right, you see when you have an identity that is self-made or whatever, then the world is not made for you anymore. God says if you do what I want you to do and you fulfill your purpose, then the whole world was created for man. So the whole world becomes a base for man. You stand on the earth, and the earth is a base for man and his ability to function. But if you don't do what's right, then the earth underneath you becomes lice. And instead of the earth being a base for man becomes a base for lice. The lice live on man instead of man living on the earth. The earth turns to lice, and man becomes the means and not the end. Now, even the smallest gnat is more important than you, and you're going to be a base for it instead of the world being a base for you. So in that way, God showed them how much the world is bankrupt, is useless, if you don't use it the proper way. So the 10 utterances with which God created the world, parallel the 10 makos, would show both God's control of the world, and that if you don't do what you're supposed to be doing, there's a breakdown of society completely. Those 10 utterances are broken down completely. There's no purpose for them. They were created, the world was created, to serve man and help him do what he's supposed to do. If he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, then there's no purpose for society, there's no purpose for the world functioning properly, and man, instead of being aided by the world, is harmed by the world. And then, there's another aspect here, mida keneged mida. The Midrashim say that the Egyptians hurt the Jews in various ways, and they were paid back now through the 10 plagues. They didn't let the Jews use the rivers or whatever to immerse themselves, the women to immerse themselves or whatever. They didn't give the Jews a chance to drink water or whatever. They enslaved them, and they made them work in ways that they couldn't drink. So all of those things God took revenge on the Egyptians and showed that they're evil. There's a judge and there's judgment. Things are in this world are not hefker. You do right things, you get rewarded. You do negative things, you get punished. And that's why every plague that hurt the Egyptians also benefited the Jews. Because now the Jews had water to sell to the Egyptians and became rich from selling water. So it hurt the Egyptians, it benefited the Jews. They see that there's reward and punishment. And they see that what they did wrong, they're being paid in kind. So you see that it's God-given retribution. And you see that the world's not just, things don't just happen. When you see a correlation between what you did and what you're getting, you understand that, that there's a God who's controlling the world. And that is a incentive to the Egyptians to repent, because they see that there's an accounting. So maybe we have to change our ways so we don't end up getting punished for all the things that we did. So like we said, this was a gradual urging, a gradual coercion, little by little, of the Egyptians to do tshuva, gave them the incentive. How so? The first way we said is to show that God controls the world, right? And the second way is that there's reward and punishment. There's a reckoning, an accounting that has to be given for what you do. And also, they saw there's a difference between the Jewish people and the Egyptians. They saw the plagues affected the Egyptians, they didn't affect the Jews, right? And they saw also that the righteous are rewarded and the wicked are punished. All of this was what's called, was an incentive, little by little, to the Egyptians, hopefully they would exercise their free choice properly. That's for the Egyptians. That was the purpose of the 10 plagues vis-a-vis the Egyptians, all the things we mentioned. The Jewish people, there was an extra benefit. The Jews should learn from here how God mocked the Egyptians. What is the idea of mockery of the Egyptians? The Gemara says, "Kol lechanusa asura, chutz milechanusa davarizor." All mockery, all lechanus is a mockery. Yeah, it's what's a better word? Scoffing. Okay, but lechanus is really like joking. It's making a joke of serious things, making light of it. And therefore, you're mocking it, you're scoffing it. That's a letz. A letz is a clown, but it's also a scoffer, somebody who makes light of serious things. So it says all leitzonis is prohibited, because if you make light of serious things, you're not going to do them. It says one leitzonis can push away 100 musr tochachos, 100 rebukes, because once you make light of the things not important, you're not going to take it seriously anymore. The only leitzonus that's permissible is leitzonus davodazor, mocking idolatry, because that's exactly the point of mockery. Instead of making idolatry respectable and serious and having to deal with it in a refined way, make fun of it and show that it's meaningless. The evil in the world, instead of refining it and respecting it and making it respectable and having to deal with it in a respectable way, show it for what it is. It's really nothing. It's unimportant. It's a joke, right? That's what Sheker is. It's only a dimyon, right? Really, evil doesn't exist. It's only a figment of people's imagination, because what's really substantive and real and important in this world is what's good. What's bad is only there to give you free choice, but it doesn't really exist. It's not really a substantive thing. So the more you make light of it, the more you mock it, the more you put it in its place. And it doesn't become an issue then that you would want to follow, because it's a joke. It's a nothing. It's not serious. So just the same reason why mockery of serious and important things is prohibited, mockery of things that are really not important and not serious is a very positive thing. You're putting the thing in its proper perspective. So, therefore, the Jewish people had to see, they lived in Egypt, and they began to think that what the Egyptians had and what they represented was pretty important, right? It was serious, it was respectable, it was whatever, and that was evil. So they had to see that the evil was really nothing. It was a joke. It was something to mock, something that had no substance to it. It wasn't something to be taken seriously. And that would enable them than to be stronger in how they embrace that which is true and that which is right, because it's impossible not to be influenced by the evil and to respect it and to consider it something valuable or whatever, And in order to really embrace what is right, you have to see that embracing the other side, the other way, is meaningless. It's useless. It's a joke. The more you understand that, the more you're able to embrace the good. The more you think that the bad is worthwhile and powerful and attractive and enticing, the harder you have more of a dilemma of which of these two paths should you choose. But if you show that the path of evil doesn't really exist, it's really just a joke, then you have no too much trouble choosing the right one, because there's only one path. There's only one option. And then you can make the choice. And that's what we said. The plague showed how bankrupt, how much of a joke, how much worthless thing was the identity of the Egyptians, the resources of the Egyptians, the purposes of the Egyptians. When you don't do it God's way, they showed that it was a joke. It was something to be mocked. The Beis Halevi says that the purpose of the plagues was to slowly take the Jewish people from the 10 levels of Tuma that they were on, even though I know it says that there are 49 levels of Tuma, but somehow there are 10 klipos, 10 shells of Tuma that a person can be subservient to, and each maka took away another shell, another layer of Tuma, and to bring them to Kedusha, right? And the way to leave the Tuma is to see that it's really non-existent. It's really a joke. It's really not something to be taken seriously. And the more you see that that option doesn't exist, then you're drawn towards the option of what's good and what's pure and whatever. There's another parallel between the 10 plagues, and that's the 10 nisyonos, the 10 tests which Avraham Avinu went through. The idea being that in addition to showing us how bankrupt, how not serious, how much of a joke the evil is, it also brought them out and showed them and strengthened their desire to bring out their potential. Avraham Avinu, with his 10 trials and tests, created the reservoir of strength. We spoke about this last week for the Jewish people. Created their potential, their character traits, right, were passed on by the Avos to all subsequent generations. So the Jewish people had tremendous potential, and they have a tremendous reservoir of powers to draw upon because of Avraham Avinu's 10 tests. Now, the more that we are strengthened in our belief in reward and punishment, in the fact that God rules the world, in what the purpose of the world is, so it brings out our potential. The more we call upon those strengths that Avraham Avinu created for us. So the 10 plagues, at the same time that they showed us the joke that the evil is, it gave us a chance and to see God's control over the world and to see Sar and Onish and to give us the incentive to want to then bring out our potential and use it. So it corresponded to the 10 tests which Avraham Avinu went through, which gave us tremendous potential. That potential will be realized with the aid of the 10 plagues, both by making the option of going after the evil less of an option, and also by, therefore, making the option of us bringing out our potential and recognizing it much greater. So that's also what the 10 plagues did. And there's another benefit. And that is, it showed us how different we are than the Egyptians. We weren't affected by the plagues, and they were. There was a natural barrier between us. The same time, what was happening to the Egyptians either wasn't affecting the Jews or was affecting them in a positive way. So we saw that we can't assimilate, and we're not one with the Egyptians, we're different. And that is the purpose of the Jewish people, is to be different, to be an Am Levada Gishkon, to dwell apart, not isolated, but insulated from the rest of the world, because we're different. We have a different goal, we have different responsibilities, we're a different neshama. And therefore, we can't assimilate with the rest of the world because we're not the same. And in order to develop that, those positive differences, we have to be insulated from the world. And the truth is that we don't really have too much of a choice. The nations of the world are compared to water and we're compared to oil. They can't mix, but they can coexist. And the oil can float on the water, protect the water, and the water support the oil. But there's always that surface tension that separates them. So the Jewish people are separated. We dwell apart, right? And the Reb Chaim Volozhin says, when we choose not to, we choose to try to assimilate and break down those barriers of difference between the Jew and the non-Jew. So then, if we don't make kiddush, if we don't sanctify ourselves, then the goy makes up dolo. He separates us, just like the oil. When the oil gets mixed into the water, what pushes it to the surface? The pressure of the water. The water pressure pushes it up. So the goyim push us out. And we can either be badad, separate, in a positive way, and then we read the sentence, Vayishkon Yisrael detach badad, that the Jewish people dwell in security apart from the nations of the world, and everything is secure and it's fine, and we can coexist with the nations of the world very nicely. And we read that on Simchas Torah. It's in the last sefer of the Torah. Or we can choose not to separate, not to be apart, not to be insulated, to try to assimilate, and then the end result will be the goy will make havdalah, and we'll read a different pasuk. We're still going to be apart, but we're going to read Eicha Yashva Vadal, and that we read on Tisha B'Av. So we have the choice. You want to have Tisha B'Av, or you want to have Simchas Torah. If you choose to be apart, you can coexist very nicely and be very, very much secure. If you don't want to, then you're going to still be apart, but it's going to come from very negative things. So we learned that from the Esther Makos too. We saw that, what's it called, that the Jews and the Egyptians were different. And God separated what happened to the Egyptians and what happened to the Jews. We're different people. We're not part and parcel of the host culture that we live amongst. And telling this over from generation to generation, all these lessons that God controls the world, there's reward, there's punishment. Right, that the evil that Egypt represented was bankrupt. It's to be mocked. It's a joke. All of those lessons, people were to tell over to their children and grandchildren till today. And when you tell it over and you think about it and you realize it and you learn about these things, then the Dakim, all of you will know I'm God. Not just you'll tell your children things that will make them know you're God. But by reviewing these things and feeling the responsibility of telling to your children, you'll know that there's a God too, because it'll strengthen your emunah. So retelling the 10 plagues throughout the generations strengthens the belief of both the children who are receiving it and the parents who are talking about it. It strengthens everybody. And the custom is, when you say the 10 plagues, to take a little bit of the wine and put it out of the cup, right, with your pinky. Or your finger. So it's thinking that the plagues represent that this is the finger of God. So you want to, what's it called, represent and think for yourself and arouse yourself. Wine is a vehicle of arousal. It sensitizes you. You know, if you drink the right amount. If you drink too much, it sensitizes you too much. But if you drink the right amount, it makes you more sensitive. So the purpose of the Esher Makos was to sensitize us. And also, we taking out a little wine also represents the idea that you're detracting from your simcha, because the Makos also were there to punish the Egyptians and to show the bankruptcy and the joke of what Egyptian culture was, right? And to punish them, to give them free choice. So there was a positive side, a positive lesson from the 10 plagues, and a negative lesson. So for the positive lesson, we take a little bit of the wine out on our finger and represent the fact that this is something that should arouse us to action. Fingers are the active part. Same time we're taking it out of the cup, because we can't be totally happy because there's another side to these makos that serves as a punishment to the Egyptians. For that, we're not so happy. But on the other hand, the makos are something that can teach us, arouse us, sensitize us, or whatever. So we take the wine on our finger, but we take it out of the cup to show that there's one aspect of negative against the Egyptians, to try to coerce them in a a way that still afforded them free choice to make the right choices. For that, we're not so happy, because they had to suffer. On the other hand, we want to arouse and sensitize ourselves with that wine on our fingers to show that it helps us to bring out our potential and to function the way we're supposed to function. Any questions on this? So that pretty much was the purpose, both for the Egyptians and for the Jews, of the 10 plagues before we went out of Egypt.
Thank you. Can I just quickly ask you?
The what? Yeah.
The people who like mock truth and they just basically they kind of make fun and
right.
That is running away from reality and that type of
right.
thing.
That's a terrible sin. It says that Kas Leitzin, or Tzonim, is one of the groups that will not see God's face in the future. Because they've taken the serious things in the world and make them into nothing. And therefore, to them, they're nothing. So you won't. The real reality is God. And you've denied that reality, so neither can I get me, you're not going to see that reality.